history tends to make a preferential option for the non-poor, for the dominant class and culture, whatever that might be. In subsequent sessions of this five-part series, we'll look at the Columbus Quincentenary and racism, and then at the Columbus Quincentenary and economic oppression, and then finally end up in the fifth session looking at some, really trying to dig into how do we respond, some visions for the new creation. So my apologies that we don't give enough time to how can we respond in these initial sessions, but we will look at that more in the fifth session. Just to recap a wee little bit, yesterday in the first session, we began to explore the concept of cultural myths. Cultural myths as belief systems, often unspoken, that run us individually and that run us as a society unless we confront them, uncover them, and intentionally defy those of them which are destructive. I'd like to just have us dig in to begin with the slideshow, without too many further words of introduction. Although let me say a couple of things. Most of you are aware, I'm sure all of you are aware, that in the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America, this year has been declared a year of repentance, remembrance, and renewal. Remembrance, repentance, and renewal. And I would just say, for a moment, look at the why of that. Why remember the realities, the injustices of 500 years past? And I must say that to me, the Columbus Quincentenary is not looking at Columbus, that Columbus is a metaphor for ourselves, and that the stories of Columbus, the way we learn about Columbus, what we believe about Columbus, helps establish patterns of thinking that dictate the way we relate to as individuals and as nations. So to look at Columbus is not, from my perspective, to look at Columbus. It's to look at ourselves as a people and to redefine our future as a people. I wanted to read one quote that I thought was very interesting. The Columbus myth functions as a kind of secular book of Genesis for the United States. In the beginning, there was Columbus, and he was good, and brave, and skillful, and determined, and ambitious, and so are we. Usually the message is implicit, but from time to time it's made explicit. Some of you may remember the PBS special on Columbus last fall, I believe it was. In one of the episodes, the mayor of Columbus, Ohio, told an interviewer, "Columbus reflects all the things that are good, right, and decent and honorable about our country." There's a kind of transference between the qualities of Columbus, the actions of Columbus, and ourselves. And I think that it's that transference and reality that we need to dig into. There are many ways to dig into it. There are many sources of literature in our country. For a few minutes, we'll just look at one of those pools of literature, and that's children's textbooks. So, let's see. I also would like to say that this slideshow is not my own. I attribute it or credit NECA, the Network of Educators on Central America, for excellent work in putting it together. Bill Bigelow of NECA spent some time reviewing some 32 texts, I believe. These are main texts, current texts, new texts on Columbus, and this comes from that. The first point is an obvious one, perhaps, but I think it's vital. All the books on Columbus get children to root for Columbus. They take his side. From the very beginning, he is the good guy. They do this by portraying him as handsome and benevolent looking. Even children who can't yet read know that beauty and handsomeness equals goodness. He's also studious, serious, has a good orthodontist, strong chin, perfect teeth. He likes children. Children like him. He's reverent. Above all, he's reverent. The link between Columbus and Christianity is a constant. And of course, Columbus maintained he was a strong Christian. But it's important to analyze how books portray the link between God and Columbus. It's worth remembering here that there is nothing reliably known about Columbus' appearance. No portraits were painted during his lifetime. Obviously, there were no photographs. So illustrators are free to invent the image of Columbus that they choose. He was brave, he was smart, and he was determined. But he had his own way of doing things, and he didn't listen to anybody. He was probably the greatest sailor of his time. There's a streak of machismo in the myth of Columbus. He had his own way of doing things and didn't listen to anybody else. It's important to think about the kind of values being taught little boys and girls, particularly little boys, in what it means to be a man. You know, parenthetically, I've just got to say that this ties into so many other different sessions being offered here. I was in on Bill's session a little bit this morning about what it means to be a man. And here we see from the very beginning some definitions. In children's books, Columbus has no friends, no community. He barely relates to people at all. What's important to Columbus is ambition. The message is pay no attention to people, relationships, community, but pursue your ambitions. Ambition is what's important. We learn that Columbus discovered that the world was round. In fact, every educated person in Europe in 1492 knew that the world was round. They also had a pretty good idea how big it was. Columbus' great contribution, if you want to call it that, was that he vastly misestimated the size of the globe. He thought it was about 2,500 miles from Spain to Japan. It's more than 2,500 miles from New York City to San Francisco, so he was off by a good measure. When Christopher Columbus was a child, he always wanted to be like St. Christopher. He wanted to sail to faraway places and spread the word of Christianity. Again, here's that link between Columbus and Christianity from the very first paragraph of this book. The children's book writers invent a whole childhood for Columbus. How do they know what he wanted as a child? Columbus said very little about his background. However, the writers want to get children into Columbus hopes, into Columbus dreams.
Can I ask a question? Sure. Is this a secular textbook?
Oh, these are secular textbooks, yes.
That's not a textbook. That's Olaire's book on Christopher Columbus, which is a children's biography.
Excuse me, you're right. And let me say, you're right. These aren't just textbooks. Okay. They are also biographies. And I said they're current. His survey included the most current, including those still in the publisher's hands. But they also include older texts. Okay. And you're right. And I didn't intentionally delete that, but that's true.
That's true.
You can't teach that way.
Well, but again, it's textbooks and it's biographies. But it's children's books on Columbus.
You can't go around talking about God and Columbus in the classroom.
Well, you could read a storybook about Columbus that talked about God and Columbus. Seriously, you couldn't.
You have to be real careful.
Okay, I would trust your statement of that. You're a teacher. You could pick up a children's book in a library that talked about God and Columbus.
Well, I'm sure, yeah.
And your point in that case is very well taken, that it isn't just text. It's also children's books about Columbus. When Christopher Columbus was a child, children, readers, spend time aboard ship with Columbus as a boy. So by the time children, along with Columbus, encounter the others, the native people of the Caribbean, they are firmly in Columbus camp. They've spent all their time with him, they've gone through his hardships, they've grown up with him. Who else could they identify with? I'm going to go back just a minute. Columbus' wish had come true. He was a sailor. The books, especially those for younger children, will put kids on a first-name basis with Columbus. Christopher's wish had come true. They spend time with him at night, looking at the stars. Soon he rose above his shipmates, for he was clever and capable and could make others carry out his orders. The literature divides people into two classes. On one side, the clever, the capable, the worthy, the significant, the Columbuses. On the other, the dull and incapable, the unworthy, the insignificant, Columbus men and the Indians. One class has the capacity and right to give orders, to make decisions. The other is good only for carrying out those orders. Kids spend time with Columbus reading books and studying maps. He also began to think that the Lord had chosen him to sail west across the sea to find the riches of the east for himself and to carry the Christian faith to the heathens. His name was Christopher. Had not the Lord chosen his name saint, Saint Christopher, to carry the Christ child across the dark water of a river? There's a lot going on here. First, the writers label the other people of the world as heathens. Some books call them inferior, pagans, or even savages. Without suggesting to children that there may be something wrong with looking at other human beings as inferior. The books do not encourage children to distance themselves from Columbus' own self-evaluation. There's no encouragement to question. It also could be that the Columbus myth that children first encounter, that it is in the Columbus myth that children first encounter the idea that God takes sides in the world and God is on our side. God is certainly not on the side of the unwashed heathens. This is not a cheap shot at Dan Quayle. This quote is from the Gulf War. It's a question of, are we on God's side? I'm confident we are. By the time kids march through school and encounter an event like the Gulf War, they've already been exposed to this framework. God is on our side and we are on God's side. So the introduction to this notion, first in the Columbus myth, begins to prepare them to accept U.S. foreign policy without question. Quayle even looks a little like Columbus, doesn't he? Good orthodontist. Same orthodontist, maybe. Nice smile, huh? Kids experience disappointment with Christopher as he's turned down by the King of Portugal in his scheme to make it to the East Indies by sailing west. Finally, Columbus meets up with King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella in 1486. Columbus is turned down by the King and Queen a couple of times. There may be a reason Columbus is turned down so often, not usually talked about in the books. Columbus' demands are pretty steep. He wants 10% tax-free of all the wealth that would be returned via the western route, brought back not just to himself, but all 10% of that brought back not just by himself, but that which is brought back by everyone forever. So his sons would get 10% and their sons and so forth. He also wants to be declared Admiral of the Ocean Sea, a title that would give him a cut of the booty captured on the high seas by the Spanish ships. The Admiral title would also be hereditary. Finally, he demands that he be declared Governor and Viceroy of any lands he finds, titles that would give him virtual dictatorial powers in those lands. Columbus is a businessman and he's driving a hard bargain. Finally, for a variety of complicated reasons, including the defeat of the Moors in southern Spain and the expulsion of the Jews, some 120 to 150,000, and the confiscation of their wealth, the king and the queen agree to Columbus' demands. He's off. Aboard ships, Columbus is steady. He's in control. Remember, he's clever. He's capable. He's the sturdy, solid fellow children are unambiguously led to identify with. However, his men are swarthy hordes. They're ugly and rebellious. The two characteristics almost always go together. They are only good for carrying out orders, and they can't even do that. These images are consistent. Did you ever read Archie comic books when you were a kid? These sailors look a little like the Jugheads. Perhaps one of the reasons the men come off so poorly in the children's books is because anything that goes wrong with the Columbus mission later on can be blamed on these men. Some of the books for older children acknowledge that slaves were taken and there was brutality, but these images function implicitly to blame the men for all the evil doings. Some of the books explicitly blame the men, that is Columbus men. I will talk to them, said Columbus. Again, Columbus is the in-control fellow. In fact, he is the only one with voice, with consciousness. The men are portrayed as voiceless rabble. This Columbus looks like George Washington, doesn't he? The real father of America. Sometimes he tries to persuade the men. He tells them God wouldn't like what they're doing, or they're not going to get rich unless they stick with him. Other times he threatens, cajoles. But finally, land is sighted. This may be the real core of the Columbus myth, the first landing and encounter between two peoples. Of course, because until now, we've only been in Columbus' head, only seen the world through Columbus' eyes, the encounter becomes one between us and them. Again, I think it functions as a metaphor. It establishes a framework within which children understand relationships between people in today's world, us and them. The first encounter is described in virtually identical words in all the books. The sailors, quote, the sailors rowed Columbus to the shore. He stepped onto the beach. He got onto his knees and said a prayer of thanks. Columbus named the island San Salvador. He said it now belonged to Ferdinand and Isabella. Now think what's happening here. Columbus is a representative of an empire thousands of miles away. He comes to a new land. It already has a name. It's called Guanahani by those who live there. Columbus immediately renames the island San Salvador, and then he takes possession of the land in the name of these distant emperors. Quite simply, this is an act of naked imperialism. Yet not one book reviewed ever encourages children to ask the very basic question, what right did he have to do that? After all, there were already people living there. Consequently, it's left to children to puzzle it out and arrive at answers for themselves. They may not do it consciously, but they need to have some kind of explanation for why this can happen. I don't know what they come up with, but you can imagine some of their answers. Columbus is white, and the Indians are not. White people have a right to rule over people of color. Columbus is a Christian, and they're not. Christians have a right to rule over non-Christians. Or perhaps it's because Columbus and his men are heavily armed. Might makes right. Or because Columbus is coming from a more technologically complex, more acquisitive society, and those people have a right to rule others. Just parenthetically, stepping aside from the slides for a minute, I would pull us back to the painting that we looked at, those of you who were in the session yesterday, and just by examining a painting commissioned in the 1830s by the US Senate, many of the myths that that painting seemed to depict that you listed over there on the board are similar to what we see being spoken of or depicted in these children's books. The images reinforce the message of the text, the powerful, the righteous. The images are consistent. One book that did not acknowledge that there were people on this land, there was one book that did not acknowledge that there were people on this land that Columbus found. It's a book by Robert Young from the Let's Celebrate series. Young writes, "The next morning, October 12, 1942, the sailors saw an island. It was big with many trees and fruit. Some sailors rowed Columbus to shore in a small boat. He fell to his knees on the sandy shore." In other words, not even indicating the reality of human beings on that land. This is the final illustration in the book. Columbus and his men on sandy shores, palm trees, and no people. The end. All the rest of the books, except that one, do acknowledge that there were people on the islands. They also acknowledge that they were friendly. And if we can believe Christopher Columbus, they were friendly. According to his journals, they were friendly. There are only two written sources we have for this first voyage. The first is a letter Columbus wrote aboard ship in February 1493, and the other is his journal, which comes down to us as the transcription of a transcription made by the Spanish priest Bartolomé de las Casas. If we can believe either of these sources, the native people were friendly. Columbus said they were generous, kind, intelligent, and good-looking. At one point, he wrote that they were the best, quote-unquote, best people in the world. Bartolomé de las Casas, incidentally, was the priest, the first priest who became ordained a priest in the Americas, who was came as a landowner, a wealthy landowner, hacienda owner, but became a vehement and passionate advocate for the rights of the native people. The natives were friendly, but they didn't look like this. This is from The Cruise of Mr. Christopher Columbus. The book is out of print now, but because it was published by Scholastic, it's still available in lots of elementary libraries. First of all, notice that all the people look alike. It's a common feature of the Columbus books that all Indians look alike. The idea that people in the Caribbean would be wearing blankets and riding in birch bark canoes is rather ludicrous. The fellow in front obviously has some fish. The person in the rear is offering Columbus a little bag of gold, helpfully labeled in English, gold. The next person has some kind of bird. It's hard to tell what the third person is offering.
Local newspaper.
Ah, that's it. It's the New York Times. Or the London Times, huh? Again, Indian people all look alike. In this case, a mirror image of each other. The familiar icons of colonialism, the sword, the cross, the flag. Parrot. Promise. This one promises something virtually that is not delivered in the narrative. The people on the shore, they're going to be encouraged to imagine that the children are going to be encouraged to imagine the scene from the people who were there first, the people on the shore. Up to this point, children have been in Columbus' thoughts, his hopes. They've only heard his voice. Surely some book might encourage kids to imagine what the Indians were going through. How might the Indians have interpreted this strangeness? Instead, there's silence. The Indians have no voice in these books. The Indians are objects, they're things, they're background, they're voiceless. Perhaps translate without intelligence. Now look at how language masks reality. Columbus took six Indians back to the ships and set sail. I took a bath, I took a vacation, I took my kids to the zoo. Took is a neutral sounding word. In fact, Columbus kidnapped people. We know he kidnapped them because he said so. He called them captives and he complained when they tried to escape. Quote unquote, two of them ran away last night. They got away like chickens, unquote, from his journal. Get a hold of Columbus Journal, and there are some inserts, some excerpts from Columbus Journal in the American Journey book that this is based upon that I could share with you. It is in print and it's widely available. You'll notice that Columbus doesn't talk a lot about converting Indians to Christianity, and that he really talks very little about getting to Japan and China. As soon as he sees that the Indians have gold, he becomes a man possessed. And where he believes he can find gold determines every twist and turn he makes throughout the Caribbean. Finally, bouncing from island to island, he comes to the island that he names La Española, where the Taino people live, who lived there may have called Haiti or Bohia, an island that today is the countries of Haiti and the Dominican Republic. On Christmas Eve, 1492, his flagship, the Santa Maria, runs aground. Columbus is not able to save it, so he orders his men to use the timbers to build a fort. Again, the books raise no ethical questions for children about the right of people from one nation to build a fort, an armed encampment on another people's land. Nor is it clear why a fort is even needed. Just who these cannon will be aimed at. Columbus leaves 39 men behind, names the place La Navidad, and heads back to Spain. Columbus took it for granted that the Spaniards would be able to survive and prosper among the pagan and inferior Indians. Pagan and inferior Indians. This book is copyright 1989. It's called Christopher Columbus, Intrepid Mariner by Sean Dolan. Dolan would probably say in his defense, I don't think that the Indians were pagan or inferior, but that's what Columbus thought. That's the whole problem. Children are invited into Columbus' thoughts, into the mind of the colonizer, and they're left there. There is never a distancing, never an encouragement to critique these ideas of one group of people as pagan and inferior. Columbus is really a businessman. He called his mission La Empresa, the enterprise. The Tainos he brought back to Spain, the Tainos were the Indian people, the native people living on the island, were part of a kind of investment prospectus. Look what I found. He also came back telling all kinds of lies. I saw huge mines of gold, he said, and I can bring your majesties unlimited quantities. He had not yet seen any mines. There are tremendous amounts of spices, and I can bring your majesties all they desire. He had no idea if there were spices, but he wanted to talk his backers into supporting another expedition. The Tainos he returned with were things to show off, like the parrots and the little pieces of gold he had brought. No book asks children to imagine the lives of the Indians. How did it feel to be ripped apart from their culture, their families, their language, their friends, and brought to an alien land? Again, the books present Indians as mere objects. Happy as anything to be rubbing up against Western civilization. Objects of curiosity for the Spaniards. Even the body language indicates the Spaniards' position of superiority. Columbus gets his new shot of investment. If the first voyage was a little exploratory mission, 3 ships and about 100 men, the second was a full-fledged invasion. 17 ships, between 12 and 1,500 men, heavily armed, vicious attack dogs, horses, cows, pigs, sheep, and chickens. Significantly, Columbus will bring sugarcane to the Americas on that second voyage, which will have such a devastating impact on the people and ecology of the Caribbean, and also on the people of Africa. As Indians died off, the Spaniards began importing enslaved Africans. The first regulations for the slave trade were issued by Ferdinand and Isabella in 1501, just after Columbus' first trip. The Indians who lived there were wild, too. They were cannibals who ate their enemies. The issue of whether, in fact, there was any cannibalism in the Caribbean is complex and controversial. Kirkpatrick Sale in Conquest of Paradise says no. Las Casas says that whenever the Spaniards wanted to take slaves, they simply called the Indians cannibals, and that justified enslavement. Certainly, there was never any Spaniard who was an eyewitness to any cannibalism. The Caribs were a ferocious people. They ate human flesh, for which they attacked other Caribs and Arawaks. They preferred the flesh of young men. Women were captured to have babies, which were reared to be eaten at future feasts. At the age of 4, boys were taken from their mothers and trained to be warriors. Unquote. End of quote. This passage from Ken Hill's The Voyage of Columbus, copyright 1991, published by Random House. A couple of things to notice. First, the Caribs were a ferocious people. In his last excerpt, they were a wild people. Once he began classifying people with a single label, it legitimizes labeling all people with single word descriptions. This people is lazy or docile. That people is intelligent or superior. This passage invites children to embrace a racist system of classifying humanity. All this stuff about eating habits, the cannibalism of the Caribs, is not simply made up. Hills is basing this passage on the writings of a Spanish doctor who accompanied Columbus on his second voyage and wrote about what he saw. The doctor saw no Indian language, had no convincing evidence of cannibalism, but saw cannibals behind every tree. One time a bunch of Spaniards disappeared and the doctor blamed it on, quote-unquote, the cannibals. They turn up a few days later having become thoroughly lost. But Hill presents the doctor's accusations of Carib cannibalism as if they were the gospel truth. To me, part of what's significant about that is that we talk about having made tremendous progress in terms of racist and exclusionary language, but this is a 1991 textbook by Random House. In interest of time, I'm going to skip a few here and go further in the slides. Some of the men went ashore to find food. Suddenly, more than 50 Indians jumped out from behind the trees. They had bows and arrows. They attacked the men. The men fought back. One Indian was hit with an arrow. Another was badly cut. End of quote from the book. Well, now, who is the aggressor here? Remember that this what the Spaniards are doing. They're claiming the Indians' land, taking slaves, and just generally mistreating everyone and everything in sight. But the Spaniards are portrayed as the innocents, just looking for food. The Indians are the aggressors. They attack the men. The men fought back. The Spaniards' violence is self-defense. Notice also that the Spaniards are called men. The Indians are just called Indians, some other category of living thing. The Indians were surprised by the bravery of Columbus' men. They dropped their bows and ran away. That's one way of looking at it. These were the only unfriendly Indians that Columbus' crew ever saw. End of quote. So the other people are divided yet again between friendly and unfriendly. In other words, the Indians. What do you have to do to earn the friendly label? I guess it means you have to let the people from the powerful nation come in and boss you around and just accept your fate. But if you should resist and stand up for your rights, for your people, then you are labeled unfriendly. Or in today's age, perhaps communist or red or radical or subversive. I think you can see this same pattern at work today. Think about the recent history, the Ho Chi Minhs, the Sandinistas, the Cubans. Anybody who doesn't go along with the policies of the powerful, if you cooperate, like the Salvadoran government, for example, you're labeled friendly. Finally, the last two illustrations do not appear in the children's books. They're taken from the Dutch artist Theodore de Bray, who illustrates the work of the Spanish priest Bartolomé de las Casas. Again, Las Casas is the priest who advocated for the rights of the native people. His father had sailed with Columbus on his second voyage. Las Casas came to the Americas from Spain in 1502, became a wealthy landowner and a slave owner, but gave it all up to preach and write on behalf of the Indians and against the brutality that he saw. Las Casas and others described the system that Columbus established in 1495 on the island of Hispaniola. They described the system that they established on the island for getting gold. Remember that slavery wasn't profitable, and Columbus needed to prove his enterprise was going to run a profit. So Columbus ordered all Tainos over 14 years of age, and to me, this is one of the most kind of revealing ironies, that facts like the one we're talking about now are not present, not only in children's books, but in any books that most of us have read as adults. Columbus ordered all Tainos over 14 years of age to collect a little hawk's bell of gold for Spaniards every 3 months. That's about 3 ounces. In some areas, Columbus ordered them to bring in cotton instead. Those who delivered the tribute were given a copper token to wear around their necks with a date stamped. They were safe to look for gold for another 3 months. Those who didn't deliver their quota were, in the words of Columbus' son, Ferdinand, punished, some by having their hands cut off. Some were chased down and torn apart by dogs, others were mutilated. And this is according to Columbus' son. To me, what is significant about looking at pictures and words like this is that I believe we all in our lives establish maps of reality, and they're maps by which that we use, and we must have them. We use them to kind of walk across the terrain of life, and those maps contain beliefs that we often are unaware of. They are the maps that help us filter information and make judgments, make decisions, and that it's often very difficult to begin to rewrite those maps, and that when we get information that perhaps contradicts the maps that we've written for ourselves, we tend to ignore that information or do something else with that information, call it wrong. I'd like to take him. To me, the issue of these maps is one of the most important things that we need to come to grips with, and maybe just to take a couple of minutes to look at the reality of those. I think we can look at that reality from individual, personal perspectives as well as from societal perspectives. An example that I might offer of the unknown nature of the maps that we write, that we make for ourselves. I was pregnant with my first child and got the dream job of my life, which meant moving to Washington, D.C. from Seattle. And I did so, we agreed that we could do so, and my husband, who came 3 months after me, wrote me a letter while I was in Washington, D.C., a beautiful letter, talking about how his decision, he's a pastor, a clergy person, and he knew that as pastors, it's very hard to spend time with your children. And so he wrote me a letter saying that what he would like to do when he moved 3 months later would be, leaving his church in Seattle, would be to be the full-time parent, the homemaker for some time. And I read the letter from my new home in Washington, D.C., where I'd been about a week, and my first response was rage. I was furious. I was literally outraged. And I am a feminist. I consider myself a feminist. I was shocked and overwhelmed by my response. I couldn't understand it. I was ashamed of it. I thought, I can't think this way, I can't feel this way, I won't tell my husband, I'll lie to him. And he came out to visit, and to make a long story short, I couldn't lie to him, and I did tell him, and we had a horrible week, and we both cried, and we both agreed that he should do what he wanted to do. And it turned out to be the best year of our lives. He was an incredible father, an incredible homemaker, and I was happy as can be, full-time in my new job. But the point of that story to me was, there was a myth, a story within me, a map I had made. And the map said that I could do what I wanted, but my man should be out in the world. And it's the map I made because I grew up in a family where my father was an intellectual and a breadwinner and out in the world interacting. And that map could have run me and virtually destroyed my marriage. But I saw it, and I faced it, and I challenged it, and we overturned it. And did so in community, in the community of myself and my husband. I think there are, you know, that's an easy to look at example because it's personal, but there are examples on more societal levels of these maps. And I would offer maybe another example. I was recently on the campus of Texas Lutheran College doing an orientation for Lutheran College faculty who were going to be traveling overseas, and I was doing an orientation to cross-cultural learning. And I was working with a man on that campus, a tenured professor, an Hispanic man, who drove the van to the airport to pick up the professors that were coming in. And in the first session, we were talking about this concept of maps of reality. And one of the professors who had come in, and there we had more time than here, so we talked about our own, everyone talked about examples. But the professor said to me that when his colleague had picked him up at the airport in the van all the way till TLC, and they'd gotten out of the van, and not until we sat in our first session did he realize that this man was another professor. He had assumed that this man was the van driver. Do you see why he assumed it? It was because he was Hispanic. Now, there's a map in that guy's mind that Hispanic people aren't college professors, they're van drivers. Just to go into that a little bit more, I would suggest that as a society, the maps that we write are those that are to the advantage of the dominant culture. In our society, that dominant culture is obviously white men with property. And that the way we speak of current events and of history is often structured to support the interests of what is the dominant cultural ideologies. History is written perhaps to erase the voices and erase the blood of the innocents, to erase the voices of the Native Americans, to erase the voices of the Central Americans, to erase the voices of the innocents. I would just suggest that the way we talk about history and current reality shapes our future, and that's the reason we look at it. I found a couple of quotes that I loved and something else I was reading that sort of support this idea. Plato said, "Those who tell the stories rule society." And I think that that's a real statement. JFK said, "The great enemy of truth is very often not the lie, but the myth, present, persuasive, and realistic." It's always nice to have JFK and Plato support your, what you think. I would just offer that one of our challenges as people of compassion and people of faith is to identify and to uncover these myths and to begin to try to see reality not from our perspective, which is the dominant cultural ideology of our time, but to see reality from the perspective of marginalized peoples, the majority of the people in the world. To see reality from the perspective of poor, of the poor. That's enormously difficult. It requires tremendous listening, and I have no claim to be doing it. I only have claim to know that it's critical for the building of a different kind of future. I guess you'd say I'm torn, because I'd like to talk more about this. I must confess I'm not used to operating in the context of 1 hour, and that's why I've talked so long. I never talk so long. I invite talking. So accept my apology, and let me suggest that this is the opening of a conversation or a step in a conversation, and that we will all continue to converse and not just have monologue going on. But I'd like to ask us to look at this concept of reading reality from the perspective of the marginalized, take another hold on it, another picture on it, and do it from a gospel, get the insights of the gospel into this idea. To do that, if we could do a reading, a brief reading, from Mark 5:21. It's the story of the healing of two women. One of them is the daughter of a synagogue leader, The other is a poor woman who has been hemorrhaging for many years. And I'd like us all to take part in this reading, if I could ask that. We have six people who will be, let's have them stand up. The narrator, if you could stand up. Jairus, the synagogue leader, if you could stand up. Jairus' daughter, are you here yet?
Yes.
There you are. Jesus, if you could stand up. The person representing the disciples here, Jairus' friend back here, and the woman who's hemorrhaging here. If the rest of you would be willing to be the crowds and gather in the corner over here behind Jesus, and we'll do this lickety-split and then talk a little bit. So everybody else is the crowds, and you are back here with Jesus. The daughter is lying down.
She's lying down.
Yes. Let's see, we got to get the stage props here. You are crowds over here. Thank you for participating. All right. Okay, this is act one of one act, and we will begin with the narrator.
Now, when Jesus had crossed back to the other side again in the boat, a large crowd gathered around him, and he stayed close to the lake. One of the officials of the synagogue, a man named Jairus, came near. Seeing Jesus, he fell at his feet and made this earnest appeal.
My little daughter is critically ill. Please come and lay your hands on her so that she may get well and live.
The two went off together, and a large crowd followed, pushing against Jesus. There was a woman in the area who had been afflicted with a hemorrhage for a dozen years. She had received treatment at the hands of doctors of every sort and exhausted her savings in the process, yet she got no relief. On the contrary, she only grew worse. She had heard about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and put her hand to his cloak.
Oh, if I just touch his clothing, I know I shall get well.
Immediately, her flow of blood dried up, and the feeling that she was cured of her affliction ran through her whole body. Jesus was conscious at once that healing power had gone out from him. Wheeling about in the crowd, he began to ask,
"Who touched my clothing?"
His disciples said to him,
"You can see how the crowd hemmed you in, and yet you ask, 'Who touched me?'"
Despite this, he kept looking around to see the woman who had done it. Fearful and beginning to tremble now as she realized what had happened, the woman came and fell in front of him and told him the whole truth. She said to him,
"Daughter, it is your faith that has cured you. Go in peace and be free of this illness."
He had not yet finished speaking when people from the official's house arrived saying,
"Your daughter is dead. Don't bother the teacher anymore."
Jesus disregarded the report that had been brought and said to the official,
"Fear is useless. What is needed now is trust."
He would not permit anyone to follow him except Peter, James, and James' brother John. As they approached the house of the synagogue leader, Jesus was struck by the noise of people wailing and crying loudly on all sides. He entered and said to them,
"Why do you make this din with all your wailing? The child is not dead, she is asleep."
At this, they began to ridicule him. Then he put them all out. Jesus took the child's father and mother and his own companions and entered the room where the child lay. Taking her hand, he said to her,
"Talitha kum, little girl, get up."
The girl, a child of 12, stood up immediately and began to walk around. At this, the family's astonishment knew no bounds. He enjoined them strictly not to let anyone know about it and told them to give her something to eat.
Thank you.
God,
get this chair.
Miracle.
A miracle.
A miracle.
Thank you.
Oh. Well, take a minute. What images strike you? What stands out in this? What does it mean? Is it just another miracle, or is it something more? Let me ask another question, maybe particularly for those who were in the morning's Bible study with Marcus. Look for a minute at the differences between Jairus and the woman.
Well, the woman was considered unclean.
The woman?
The one who received the first healing.
She was unclean? She received the first healing. Uh-huh.
She was a woman,
which, as we learned this morning, rendered her unclean, impure, by virtue of being a woman.
What strikes me is what must have gone through that woman's mind before she came. I can imagine her in her home that morning, you know, and saying, should I do this? Should I? I've been ridiculed. I spent all my money. I know this is even against the code and the purity laws, but I've heard of this man. Margaret played it so well, you know, I mean, just trembling to think, and that kind of faith, there's something about that I think that always touches me.
I think I saw a real picture of accessibility. The person of power, who in this instance was man, had access to Jesus.
The person of power had instant access to Jesus.
It appeared that way.
Good.
It's interesting that Jesus persists in knowing who it was, despite the fact that the disciples did the usual appeal. He doesn't give up. He continues.
He continues to talk with her. I was going to call you Jairus. Excuse me.
I'm intrigued by the fact that by touching his hem, that she could be healed, and that she, that's what she believed, and he turned around and acknowledged that that's what healed her, that it was her faith that healed her,
and that it was, pardon me,
that it was her faith is what healed her, and yet it clearly says that he felt power go out just from being touched.
Again, I'm reminded of the Bible study yesterday and the discussion of the holy man. Yes?
I find it interesting that she's been sick. She's gone to doctors. Mm-hmm. She's considered unclean. Mm-hmm. But those that she had to pay her money, those who exhausted her funds, were more than likely men. Uh-huh. But yet for her to go to someone who would charge her nothing, it was just her faith. This she would feel so badly about. She would be ridiculed for this. So as long as you give your money, it's okay.
Other comments, particularly contrasting the two, Ted?
Just a little grab of a garment is a small part. The power is still there, just to be included a little bit. A sense of desperation. And that was just, you don't have to have the whole thing. It was there, but just not access.
Any other responses from those of you who were in it? Insights that you gained, those of you who were in the skit?
I felt separate from the crowd. I mean, the crowd was definitely other.
Yes.
And I don't know whether that's because that's the way it's set up. But in the process of portraying it, I guess. In thinking about the incident, I would have wanted to be in a real hurry to get him to my daughter. And this was, it was taking too much time. He had to pay attention to this this other situation. And I can imagine thinking, and it didn't cross my mind when we practiced it, but it did here, when a friend came up and said that my daughter had died, of wanting to blame Margaret for having stalled us, and that if only she hadn't been there, that maybe the master would have gotten to my daughter in time. It was flash, but it was there.
I hear it. Those are all very useful comments, and that just the feelings that you suggested illustrate or bring out the delay, that she was attended first. I wrote down just a couple of examples.
again, as we learned this morning, and I can't say it nearly as well as Marcus did, but that in first century Palestine, the honor code, the honor society, the purity codes dictated life, and that people had set social standings, and that some people were pure and some people were impure. And there were strict rules, strict rules regulating the interaction between people. For a man to have spoken with a woman not in his family, in other words, for Jesus to speak with this woman, was dramatically against the social norms of the day, against the code, against the laws, and he contradicted those codes by doing so. A couple of the other just ways of seeing how the woman was impure. She was poor, Jairus was rich. Jairus was whole, she was not whole. She was bleeding, which was another element of impurity. He was a man, as you said earlier, and she was a woman, which made her impure. He was of the ruling religious elite. She was statusless and outcast. And so we see that Jesus, in that example there, in that little text, does what Jesus does throughout the gospel, attending to the outcasts, the poor, those to whom he should not attend or should not speak. And we could see, and in particular, I would speak to the Gospel of Mark, a picture emerging in the Gospel of Mark of Jesus showing the kingdom of God to be a kingdom which dramatically overturns and breaks apart and breaks down the established social barriers that exclude some and make others elite. And in this picture, we see Jesus breaking those down simply by attending to this woman to whom he should not have attended, but also by attending to her first. Jairus waited, and he attended first to the impure, to the poor, to the marginalized. One way of that I like to see of kind of looking at society, getting a hold of society, is to look at a huge picture of circle, and that some are in the center of the circle and others are marginalized, are on the periphery. This woman was on the periphery, and Jesus moved to the periphery and attended to the periphery. It would be interesting to take just we only have 2 minutes. Take a couple of minutes just to bring ourselves to, I tell you what, we won't do that. Let's just have a kind of an assignment for reflection throughout the evening and throughout the days. Something that I found useful to do is on a piece of paper actually to draw a circle. And I would suggest that people might draw a circle, and in that circle put the people who are central to your life, the people, the institutions, the contacts, the networks that are central to your life. And then think about the marginalized of our society, people of our society who are in one way or another marginalized. Think about whether any of them are in your circle, in the center of your circle, and if not, why? In what ways do we maintain honor codes or purity codes that keep people separate, that keep some in the center of society with access to resources, some on the margins of society? And then in thinking, after thinking about the whys, I would just offer the invitation to think about ways that you might begin to break through those codes and break through those unspoken laws that create exclusivity and exclusion in our society. To think about one step. I can think in my city, and we can all think, I can think about, you know, the homeless people that I am around every day, and what are steps that I can take to go to that margin. I guess what I'd like to do is hang around and talk, if anyone else wants to talk about these ideas. And maybe, in closing, just take a moment of silence for us to reflect on these words and these thoughts, maybe a minute or two, and then go our ways. Thank you. To take an end, and I promise not to talk so much in the next sessions.